Well, over these last few Sunday evenings, we've been looking at Samson. And whatever else you might say about the Samson story, you certainly couldn't say that it's dull and pedestrian. It's a tale of divine appearances and vanquished lions and Philistine massacres and collapsing buildings. It's a roller coaster ride bursting with the most full-blooded action. And it was quite hard thinking of a passage to speak on this evening which would live up to the high drama to which we'd become accustomed. After Samson, I couldn't really preach on a genealogy or on a list of greetings or something like that. So I've gone instead for Acts 27. I'm afraid we don't have Paul here tying up any foxes and setting up their tails, setting their tails on fire. We don't have him yanking any city gates off their hinges. But we do have him caught up in a violent Mediterranean storm. And I thought that might be the next best thing. But on a more serious note, I've chosen this passage also because, of course, it's a helpful and an instructive passage. And I think it's important to mention that at the outset. We know that we can benefit from considering Paul in Philippi in Acts 16. We know that we can benefit from considering Paul in Athens in Acts 17. That's all fairly well-worn territory. But I want to say that we can also benefit from considering Paul at sea in Acts 27. It might, in our minds, just be one of those exciting biblical narratives, but it's more than that. It's a passage that is of use and of benefit to us if we consider it properly. And so I want to draw your attention then to four things as we consider Paul at sea in Acts 27. First of all, the suffering apostle. The suffering apostle, verses 13 to 20. Now, Paul's experience here in this passage is one that we might not immediately class as suffering. Elsewhere in Acts, Paul is flogged, he is imprisoned, he is stoned, he is struck across the face. And we unhesitatingly class those experiences as suffering, but perhaps not so much this experience here in chapter 27. There may be a couple of reasons for that. One is that Luke's narrative is so exciting. Normally, when you're reading an account, whether it's in a book or whether it's in a magazine article or whatever, normally when you're reading an account of human suffering, it's harrowing, isn't it? It's difficult and painful to read. But this narrative here isn't harrowing, it's exciting. It's so fast-moving and involved. The lifeboat almost going adrift in verse 16. The ropes being tied underneath the very hull of the ship. And the anchors being lowered in verse 17. The ship's cargo being thrown overboard in verse 18, then the ship's equipment receiving the same treatment in verse 19. It's all calculated to give you an adrenaline rush, not to bring tears to your eyes. So that's perhaps one reason we don't instinctively class Paul's experience here as suffering. And then the other perhaps is that shipwreck isn't a particularly meaningful concept to us today, is it? We may be anxious about cancer, we may be anxious about terrorist attacks, we may be anxious about identity fraud. But most of us don't live in mortal fear of being shipwrecked. We don't talk to one another ominously and in hushed tones about the S word. We don't think every time the phone rings, I hope that's not another person who has been caught up in some shipwreck somewhere. It's just not a prominent thing in our thinking. And so for those two reasons perhaps, as I say, we don't instinctively view Paul's experience here as suffering. But I think we should. If for no other reason, than that Paul himself includes shipwrecks in a list of his sufferings in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 25. Remember how those Corinthian believers, that church has been infiltrated by false teachers, and these false teachers are saying to the Corinthians, look, forget about Paul. Don't bother anymore with Paul. Paul's nothing like as impressive as we are. And these false teachers then had been dazzling the Corinthian believers with all their boasts. And in that chapter, well, in that whole epistle in many ways, but particularly in that chapter, Paul is responding to that situation and he's saying, actually, if you don't mind, I'll engage in a little boasting myself. But I'm not going to boast about how impressive I am. I'm going to boast about my sufferings, because it's those sufferings that really authenticate me as a true apostle of the crucified Jesus Christ. And as he does that then, as he boasts in his sufferings, and as he gives this great catalogue of his sufferings, he includes in that context the shipwrecks which he has experienced. And so, as I say, I think we should view this experience of Paul's here as suffering. And when we do that, I think it makes Acts 27 really very striking. Because you see, Paul has been experiencing suffering ever since chapter 21. One particular form of suffering, namely persecution. Paul has been a prisoner ever since chapter 21. And during that time, he has been subjected to two attempts by the Jews to kill him, one attempt by the Romans to flog him, and four appearances before different authorities to defend himself. In other words, Paul has been having a rough time. It's almost as though he's been on this conveyor belt since chapter 21, episode after episode of being maligned and harassed and buffeted by powerful and unprincipled men. But you see, as a reader then, you come to chapter 27, and you kind of think, well, at least now Paul's going to get some respite. At least now Paul's going to be able to enjoy this very straightforward voyage across the Mediterranean to Rome before he comes to his next trial and his next public appearance. At least now he's going to enjoy a period when he's crossing the Med, when there'll be no attempts to kill him and there'll be no attempts to flog him and there'll be no summons before any authorities. At least now he's going to have a little bit of calm amidst the storm of persecution. That's kind of what you're thinking as you come to chapter 27. But then suddenly, bam, Paul runs into a new and different storm. Not this time a storm of persecution, but this time a storm of hurricane force gales and of lashing rain and of massive waves. And poor old Paul, you see, has simply exchanged then one form of suffering for another. Yes, we have a chapter in which there's no floggings, no attempts on his life by persecutors. But a chapter in which instead he finds himself caught up in this horrible, harrowing storm. And life's sometimes like that, isn't it? Sometimes it's when you're already up to the eyes with one problem that suddenly another problem arises. Sometimes it's when you're already reeling from one providential blow that suddenly another providential blow is inflicted. Sometimes it's when you're already engulfed in one crisis that sometimes another crisis comes your way. And it's very tempting to think when you're in that situation, and perhaps some of you have experienced that in 2009, it's very tempting to think when you're in that situation that God is really singling you out, that it's not normal to experience such a barrage of difficulties from so many different directions in such a short space of time. But I'm simply saying, you see, in my first point this evening, That's exactly how it was for the Apostle Paul. It was while he was already grappling with fierce anti-Christian persecution that suddenly he has to grapple with a fierce Mediterranean storm. I suppose it reminds us, doesn't it, that when you go to those well-known words of 1 Corinthians 10, 13, he will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. It's talking about God's definition, not ours, of what we can bear. I'm always very intrigued by lifts. We live in a country which is health and safety mad, and in most situations, the health and safety regulations seem to be over the top in their fussiness. But lifts seem to be the one exception. They seem to be the one blind spot. So you go on a lift and it seems like it's big enough for about 3 people. And there's this sign on the side saying maximum load 16 people or something like that. And you kind of think, how on earth could you get 16 people on this lift? Well, Junie tells me it's because these lifts are usually made in countries where the people are a lot smaller than in our country, and that may be the case. But you kind of wonder how on earth it could carry that kind of weight. And as I say, it's a bit like that with 1 Corinthians 10:13, that we often find ourselves in situations, and perhaps we're already struggling with one type of suffering, already one trial, already one affliction, and we think, well, I couldn't possibly bear this other thing. I'm sure that's how Paul felt as he saw the storm clouds, the literal storm clouds, begin to gather in the sky, as he began to feel the wind getting up, as he began to feel the first drops of rain. He probably thought, look, I just can't bear this. On top of what I'm already facing, I'm on my way here to Rome to stand before the most powerful man in the world. That's enough on my plate for just now. I can't bear now being caught up in some storm in the middle of the sea. But you see, God's definition of how much we can carry is not always the same as our definition. And God sometimes says, look, by my grace you can carry a lot more than you think you can carry. I will help you through. I will give you the grace, even though you're already suffering that, even though that's already going on in your life, to now cope with this new thing from another direction that is coming your way. And so that's the first thing that we notice in this passage, the suffering apostle. Secondly, however, notice the spiritual apostle. The spiritual apostle, verses 21 to 26. Now, you can't read Paul's epistles, can you, without getting the impression that this is a deeply spiritual man. Just to give one very random example, Philippians chapter 1 and Paul's prayer for the Philippians in verses 9 to 11. His prayers are often, aren't they, so amazing in his epistles. And this one, Philippians 1, verses 9 to 11, this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ, to the glory and praise of God. Wow, what a prayer to pray. What a spiritual man this man, Paul, is. But I think that we can't remind ourselves too often that Paul maintained this level of spirituality not in some abstract vacuum, not in some ivory tower, but in the midst of so many trials and afflictions. He maintained it in the crucible of suffering. And perhaps sometimes you're tempted to doubt that. Perhaps you have the sneaking suspicion that in actual fact Paul dictated most of his letters while having his back massaged in some luxurious leisure resort somewhere in the first century world. Perhaps you can't quite believe that Paul really wrote those epistles with such spiritual insight and such spiritual material. You can't really get your head round the idea that he wrote those in the midst of sufferings. Well, it seems to me that if you do harbour that suspicion, then Acts 27 is the place for you to go. Let me just draw your attention to three remarkable things in verses 21 to 26. First of all, verse 23. So this is Paul now, and he's got the whole of the ship's company together, and he wants to address them all. And in the midst then of addressing everyone on board the ship, he says in verse 23, "Last night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me, dot, dot, dot." It's that little phrase, "the God whose I am," that I want you to think about for a moment. And Paul is saying then that he belongs to God. And of course, Paul is speaking here in a historical context in which a person could actually belong to another person. He's speaking in a historical context where slavery was a very established institution, and where, therefore, somebody could be somebody else's personal possession as a slave. And that slave, then, who belonged to somebody else, he had no rights. And the master could put that slave through anything that he wanted to put him through. He could treat him in any way he pleased, and that slave couldn't question that treatment and couldn't complain and couldn't say, "Hey, what are you doing?" Because the slave was completely at the master's disposal. Paul was living in a world in which there was that kind of setup. So that when then he talks about belonging to God, the God whose I am, he's not just using some kind of meaningless evangelical language. He is speaking against that backdrop. And he's saying effectively, "I am God's slave. I am completely at God's disposal. He may treat me entirely as he wishes. He may put me through anything he wants to put me through. And I could not complain and I could not question that because I am his slave." Now, this is something that Paul writes about often in his epistles, I suppose most famously in 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20. "You are not your own. You were bought at a price." But you see, this is my point, that you can speculate all you want as to the background to that epistle, 1 Corinthians, and what Paul was doing when he was writing that, and whether he was in a massage parlor somewhere and so on. But here in Acts 27, God is throwing a storm at him. Here in Acts 27, God is putting him through this Mediterranean storm, and it's horrible, and it's an ordeal, and it's harrowing. And for him to be able to say, then in that context, "I belong to God, I'm his slave. He's my master, and he has the right to put me through whatever he wants to put me through." When at the very moment God was putting him through this, that's quite something. That shows that we're not dealing here with some man in an ivory tower writing things that have no relevance to real life. Lindsay Brown is the head of IFES, the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, I think is what it stands for. And he writes about some of his heroes in the faith, and one of those is Sir Norman Anderson, and he writes this. He says, "Professor Sir Norman Anderson was a man of towering intellect. He lectured in Egypt and was then director of the Advanced Legal Institute in London University. For over 60 years, he supported the ministry of IFES. I was with him at one of the last public events at which he spoke before his death in his mid-80s. It was a large conference for students in England with nearly 2,000 present. During that meeting, he was interviewed by an Anglican curate in his late 20s. At that time, Professor Anderson's wife had senile dementia and she could no longer recognize him. All three of his children had died in early adulthood. I was taken aback by the curate's question. As he turned to Professor Anderson, he said, 'When you look back over your life and reflect on the fact that you have lost all your three children, and now your wife of 60 years no longer recognizes you, do you ever ask the question, why me?' It was a bold, if not insensitive, question. I was surprised by Professor Anderson's response. 'No, I've never asked the question, why me?
But I have asked the question, why not me?
And you see, there you have a man who in the crucible of suffering, his three children dying in early adulthood, his wife now not recognizing him. There you have a man who understands himself to be God's slave, at God's disposal. God has the right to put him through whatever he wishes to put him through. Why not him? He's God's slave. He's at his disposal. And I'm saying then that Paul was the same. Here he is, in the middle of a storm. Well, you thought he might have been cursing the God who was putting him through this. And he says, I'm God's slave, the God whose I am. And the second remarkable thing in these verses, verse 24, Paul is now recounting the angel's words. Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And then this, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. When I was a student at Aberystwyth, I used to go to Alpha Place Baptist Church, and there was one evening service when the person who normally did the recordings and the sound and all that kind of stuff wasn't there, and he'd asked someone else to do it in his place. And this person who was doing it didn't really have a great idea what he was doing, I think. And he was a nervous kind of fellow who was a bit kind of worried about the whole thing. And so during the sermon, while Jeff Thomas was preaching, he kept kind of adjusting the sound. He kept fiddling with it. He wasn't quite satisfied that it was right, and so he kept altering it. And after a while, this was clearly exasperating Jeff Thomas somewhat as he preached. And at the end, it was just too much for him. And kind of in the middle of a sentence, he just blurted out, "Leave it alone, please." And then carried on preaching. And I often thought that it would be rather strange if you were listening to the tape of that sermon on the CD. You'd wonder what on earth he was talking about. Suddenly he blurts out in the middle of a sentence, "Leave it alone, please." And so you'd need that background information to understand that comment. And it's a bit like that here, I think. The angel says, God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. Well, what's that about? Why should Paul be interested in being given the lives of those who sail with him? The crewmen and all the others, the 275 others on this ship. Well, I think there's probably a bit of background information here missing that we need to know. And it's this, that Paul presumably has been praying that these people would be saved, that these people would be spared, that no one would lose their lives. And that's why then it's a gracious gift to him. It's as if the angel is saying, your prayer has been answered. God has given you what you've asked for, Paul. You've been wanting the safety, the protection of all these who are sailing with you. God has graciously given you that. He's given you these lives. Now, again, just in and of itself, there's nothing surprising about that, is there? Paul praying. Paul writes about prayer so often in his letters. Just again, to pick a random example, Ephesians 6, verse 18, pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. But again, you see, it's one thing for Paul to be writing that in an epistle. But it's another thing, isn't it, for him now to be on this ship in a storm and actually to be doing it. And while everything is so chaotic and shambolic, and there's waves crashing over the ship, and it's just a mad time that he's going through. In the midst of that, to be getting down his knees and praying, Lord, I'm concerned about these people who are on the ship with me. Please protect them. Please look after them. Please don't let any harm come to them. Again, Paul, in the midst of suffering, putting into practice what he's written about. And then one other thing then in these verses that I think is remarkable. Verse 25, he continues, so keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Again, it's standard Paul stuff, isn't it? Talking about faith, having faith in God. 2 Corinthians 5:7, we walk by faith, not by sight. But again, it's one thing for him to write that in a letter. It's another thing when he's on a ship, and the sight bit is these storm clouds and these huge waves. And to all appearances, This ship is going to go down at any minute. Shipwrecks were a common occurrence, and they were fatal, and hundreds and thousands were killed on ships in that historical context. And it's another thing altogether in that situation to walk by faith and not by sight, to say, well, I'm not going to go by what I can see, this terrible storm we're in the midst of, but I'm going to go on what God has said, and I'm going to walk by faith. And so I'm saying that in those three ways we see Paul's spirituality not as some merely written, professed thing in his letters, but as something that kicks into action even in the most unlikely and the most difficult circumstances. Even in this storm, we see his spirituality shining through so strongly. And it reminds us then, doesn't it, that we should be praying all the time and preparing ourselves for when we find ourselves in suffering, in trying circumstances. While we are in better days, while we are in still water, beside still waters and in green pastures, we should be preparing ourselves as much as possible for when we're in the valley of the shadow of death, for when we're surrounded by many enemies, for when life is hard and we're surrounded by adversity, so that we too, like Paul, will flourish and shine out even in the midst of suffering. The suffering apostle, the spiritual apostle. Thirdly, the surprising apostle. This is verses 27 to 38. I was telling Brian and Michelle the other day about my PE teacher at school. And he was then my favourite teacher. He was my role model. I just thought he was great and I wanted to be like him. But one of the biggest disappointments of my young life was when one day in the dining room I saw my PE teacher eating chips for his dinner. This man who would encourage us to live so healthily, to keep so fit, to be always running and doing press-ups and all the rest of it, and there he was in the dining room eating chips. I was most disappointed. And you might, at first sight, be similarly disappointed by Paul in these verses here. Because here's this man then, and he's just spoken so reassuringly about how God is going to protect them all. God is going to keep them safe. Don't worry, have courage, it's going to be okay. God isn't going to allow one single one of us to be lost. But now, in verse 31, he seems to be adopting a different stance. There in verse 31, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless the... So what's happening here is some sailors are trying to escape from the ship. And Paul is very concerned about this, and he alerts the centurion, unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved. Hang on a minute, Paul. God has said no one's going to be lost. And yet here's Paul saying, look, if these men are allowed to go, then no one's going to be saved. And then again, verse 34, he's urging them now to take food. I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. But hang on a minute, Paul. God is going to spare you all. No one's going to be lost. It doesn't matter whether they eat or not, surely. It looks then that Paul, after being so convinced of God's sovereignty earlier on, now has got a bit wobbly on the whole thing. And now he's resorting to all these rather desperate means, making sure no one escapes from the ship and making sure everybody has enough food to eat. But I don't think we should be disappointed by what we see of Paul in these verses. I think rather it's wonderful what we see here. That here we see the man who wrote Romans chapter 9, the man who did have such a full-orbed view of God's sovereignty, God's electing purposes from before the foundation of the earth. We see that same man taking these practical steps and making sure these people didn't leave the boat and making sure that everybody ate enough food. Because you see, that's human dignity, isn't it? That yes, God is sovereign. Yes, God has foreordained all things that come to pass, but at the same time, he hasn't made human beings as robots who simply do what they've been pre-programmed to do and have no freedom to choose that decision or that decision. No, he has made human beings with a dignity so that they must act responsibly. And perhaps we can't ultimately reconcile these two strands of Paul's teaching. On the one hand, God is utterly sovereign. And yet on the other hand, we are thoroughly responsible. But Paul asserts both of them emphatically, and they come together so wonderfully in this passage. And it's why then, as we stand now on the brink of a new year, on the brink of 2010, and as we look ahead to this year, we must take seriously 1 Corinthians 1 verse 8, where Paul writes, he, and he's talking about Christ, he will keep you strong until the end. What a wonderful promise. That through all that we're going to face in 2010, we can't predict it. Through all that we're going to face, he will keep us strong until the end. He will preserve us. He will protect us. He will allow none to pluck us from his hand. And yet, at the same time, we must also take seriously Hebrews chapter 3, verse 12. See to it, brothers, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But if he's going to keep us strong to the end, why do we need to worry about us having a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God? Because both are true. And we must take both seriously. And we must rely with confidence upon his protecting power. But at the same time, we must be responsible, watching ourselves, guarding ourselves, making sure we don't stray from the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul had such a robust view of things, didn't he? Such a balanced view of things. So emphatic about a God who is sovereign and irresistible, and yet so emphatic about dignified human beings who make real choices in life. The suffering apostle, the spiritual apostle, the surprising apostle, and finally, the spared apostle. The spared apostle, verses 39 to 44. So the boat then does indeed run aground. It's wrecked and begins to be broken up, and yet through various means the passengers all reach shore safely. But you notice that in verse 42 the soldiers plan to kill the prisoners because they thought that they would swim away and escape. But then that fascinating detail in verse 43, but the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. Have you ever wondered why Luke devotes such a large amount of space to this narrative, this storm and this shipwreck there on the Mediterranean? It's huge, isn't it, really? Have you ever wondered why he does that? Well, I think that Acts is a bit like John that we were talking about this morning. Remember how we said this morning that John's gospel kind of begins and ends with the same theme, because by employing that device, John is conveying what the main point of his gospel is, namely the divine status of Jesus Christ. It begins with that and it ends with that. And I think Luke employs a similar device in Acts, that it too begins and ends with the same theme in order to convey what the main point of the book is. And in this case then, it's the irresistible spread of the gospel. It's the irresistible spread of the gospel. So in chapter 1, you have the Lord Jesus laying out that program. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Samaria and to the ends of the earth. And then that's how the book begins. And then the book ends with the gospel reaching Rome. Paul, the great Christian missionary, reaching Rome. And you can't underestimate the significance of that. Rome was the capital of the world. Rome was the greatest city. And in fact, Paul wasn't only reaching Rome, but he was going to stand, as we've already said before, the most powerful man in the world. He's going to stand before Caesar, the emperor, the world ruler, you might almost say. And it's this idea then, kind of enveloping Acts, the irresistible spread of the gospel. Jesus laying out that program in chapter 1, and then the gospel beginning to impact the greatest city in the world in chapter 28. And I think the significance of chapter 27 is that here we have this apparent obstacle in the gospel reaching Rome. Here it looks like it's not going to happen. Here it looks like Paul is going to be drowned before ever reaching Rome. It looks like the good news of Jesus Christ isn't going to reach the world's premier city. And I think it may well be the case that Luke actually intends us to see supernatural opposition behind this. It's a bit like in chapter 8 of his gospel, where you have Jesus crossing over the Lake of Galilee to the other side, to the region of the Gerasenes. And it's this explicitly Gentile area. There's pigs feeding there. It's a really Gentile area. And it's this really godless place where immediately he's met by a man who's possessed by multiple demons. And it's very interesting that as he crosses to that place, to kind of take his good news to a new and as yet untouched region, on the way over there's a storm, and that's when he has to still it. Peace, be still. And I think it's again that sense of the supernatural opposition, Satan himself trying to stop Jesus from reaching that region, and here Satan himself, the powers of evil themselves, trying to stop the gospel from reaching Rome, trying to overturn Paul through a storm before he can get there. But you see, it doesn't work. And God ensures that his man gets to Rome. And even at the last, when the soldiers were about to do what the storm couldn't do and kill Paul, even then God produces this most unlikely means. As a Roman centurion of all people who's sympathetic to him and wants his life to be spared. And it's just ramming home this theme then. Nothing can stop the spread of God's gospel. Satan cannot do it through storms. He cannot do it through soldiers. He cannot do it through any kind of opposition and resistance. The gospel will spread throughout this world, and men and women will hear and will respond. Indeed, the very last word of Acts in the Greek, it's one word, and it's without hindrance. Notice the last verse of Acts 28. Boldly and without hindrance he preached the kingdom of God and taught about the Lord Jesus Christ. And that word without hindrance is actually the very last word of the book of Acts. There's no hindrance to the gospel of God. It will go forth and it will triumph in this world. And what an encouragement for us then, as we start 2010. What an encouragement for us here in our own patch, that as we seek to witness, as we seek to witness to our friends and families, and it sometimes seems that there is such insurmountable opposition, as it must have seemed to Paul as he was on that ship, am I really going to reach Rome? And yet we must grasp hold of this, that the spread of the gospel is irresistible. God will ensure that his gospel triumphs. And then as we look out to the world abroad then, and another year in which doubtless many Christians will be killed for their faith, many more imprisoned for it, and as there will be many assaults by Islam and by other forces on the Church of Jesus Christ, again we need to grasp hold of this. The spread of the gospel is irresistible. God will ensure it goes to all those to whom he has intended it will go. And that multitude no man can number from every nation, tribe, people and language will be brought in to the kingdom of God. Let's have great confidence tonight in this God who ensured Paul got to Rome and ensured that the gospel turned that first century world upside down. Amen. We're going to close with 632, How Good Is the God We Adore, Our Faithful Unchangeable Friend.